In this powerful installment of The Cauldron, British Columbia, 1870 to 1919, historian British Goff confronts one of the province's most painful historical episodes, the reoccurring waves of smallpox and their devastating impact on Indigenous communities, focusing especially on the role of William Head Quarantine Station during the First World War. Goff unpacks the intersection of public health, imperial logistics, and racial politics. In 1917, as the Allied powers scrambled for manpower on the Western Front, thousands of Chinese laborers were transported from China through British Columbia en route to the European trenches. Before continuing their journey, many were held at William Head, ostensibly to protect the Canadian population from infectious diseases, but also reflecting the racialized anxieties of the time. Goff gives this episode a broader historical context, tracing back to the smallpox epidemics of the 19th century that had decimated Indigenous populations. In a powerful and deeply researched rebuttal, he takes aim at the accusation, circulating in some circles, that British or Canadian authorities deliberately spread smallpox as a means of clearing land or eliminating Indigenous resistance. Goff does not minimize the catastrophic consequences of colonial neglect, but he challenges what he sees as conspiratorial oversimplifications, arguing instead for a tragic interplay of ignorance, indifference, and administrative failure.
In 1893, British Columbia acquired its first quarantine station at William Head, which is near Machozen, British Columbia, on the south coast of Vancouver Island. It's now a security prison run by the Government of Canada. It was, in the days of the quarantine station, run by the Marine Department of the Government of Canada, which comes into existence at the time of Confederation. The seas and the oceans of Canada are a federal control and not a provincial control. The story of how this came into existence is fascinating, and it comes to the heart of the question of whether or not smallpox was introduced as a lethal component by government to reduce the number of Indigenous peoples in British Columbia. That's a very questionable assumption, but good historical thinking cannot ignore that charge. And I intend to begin with that and then come through to the quarantine and then to conclude with the remarkable passage of some 80,000 Chinese laborers in the Chinese Labor Corps. They were destined for the Western Front in France and Flanders under the employ of the British government. Disease has always been a factor in human history. It's the silent killer. We know of scurvy. We know of measles. We know of smallpox. We know of other things of this sort. But none seems to have been as so noticeable or as destructive as smallpox. There are records that indicate whole villages. I cite the Mandan people on the Missouri River who disappeared in 1834, 1835, a whole civilization lost to smallpox. In the fur trading era, Sir Alexander Mackenzie, the trader traveler, was inoculating Indigenous peoples along the way during his travels. It might be said, of course, that this was self-sustaining because he wanted trade to exist, and without Indigenous persons, you couldn't have any trade. But Jenner had introduced smallpox or cowpox as an anti-smallpox vaccine in the 18th century, and the wisdom of this and the efficacy of it had quickly spread around the world. In the British Columbia case, and in the colony of Vancouver Island in particular, with which we begin this narration, we need to remember that there was no public health service. There were no doctors who were paid by governments to undertake inoculations. It was not until 1871 that the federal government, by its extension of its powers through the Indian Act, was able to introduce a federal responsibility. And Israel Wood Powell, doctor and colonel, was given charge by Sir John A. Macdonald to bring forth medical treatments and to judge the health of Indigenous persons in British Columbia. He was sorely restricted in what he could do by the fact that there was no government money that was provided for health and welfare of Indigenous persons. In larger measure, we have to remember that in the 19th century, public health was usually confined to providing safe water and even sewage if it could possibly be undertaken. But there were very, very few hospitals. And those hospitals which developed were invariably for persons who were insane. In fact, the first hospital in Victoria was an insane asylum. And then in addition to that, by 1860, we did have in Victoria, we had a marine building, which was responsible for the health of shipping coming and going. This brings me to my next point. When John Sebastian Helmkin, one of the original doctors and pharmacists who arrived in Vancouver Island, reached here in Victoria in the summer of 1850, he was met by Governor Blanchard, who went on board the ship that was the immigrant ship, which was anchored in Esquimalt Harbor. And it had been placed in quarantine, not by Helmkin, but by the captain, because in those days, the British Marine Department, the Board of Trade, had rules and regulations that if anybody was found on passage with smallpox, then the vessel needed to be quarantined for a certain period of time until it was all clear and the medical opinions were granted and given that there was no smallpox on board the ship that would come ashore, which would infect the people ashore in the colonial jurisdiction, whether they were First Nations, Métis, Hawaiian, Chinese, whatever. That was the policy. So the quarantining was done under British regulations. Colony of Vancouver Island operated under colonial regulations. The Hudson Bay Company had no remit or authority to exercise its own health care conditions. There were physicians here. There were inoculations given to the Hudson Bay Company community because they looked after themselves. As to the Indigenous nations, the following needs to be remembered, that from about 1853-52, large numbers of waterborne First Nations came to Victoria. It was the great rendezvous in the summer, particularly in the late summer. So when you get a congestion of people, you can get a rapid circulation of a disease. The Haida were notoriously successful at their visits here, and to such a degree that the citizens of the colony, I'm speaking now about the whites of the Hudson Bay Company, and the settlers here became alarmed at the disproportionate number of militant First Nations persons in the harbor. The Tsimshian came as well. The Bellicoola came as well. The Cowichan came much more easily, of course, and many other tribes as well. Also here arrived those from across the strait, the Macaw and the Clallam people, for instance. So Victoria becomes a potential breeding ground for smallpox. We roll forward to the year 1862, and in that particularly prominent day of 1862, a ship called the Brother Jonathan arrived from San Francisco. It is estimated by the date of arrival was the 12th of March, 1862. And on this vessel was a person who had smallpox, similarly to the affair which Governor Blanchard met Helmkin. But in this case, there was no testing, no screening of the carrier. And this person is called and referred to in the literature as Patient Zero. The vessel, Jonathan, Brother Jonathan, arrived from San Francisco. The British colonist newspaper reported that the smallpox case was not considered a dangerous one, so the disembarking passenger was not detained or quarantined. In fact, Patient Zero would, within days, ignite one of the most devastating epidemics in Canadian history. That's why Tom Swanky, in his book, The True Story of Canada's War of Extermination on the Pacific, claims that the when was the case of smallpox not dangerous, and who promoted this falsity and why. Now, Swanky's book, when it was published, was a sensation because it implies that the government, the colonial government, of headed up by Governor Douglas, was complicit in the business of allowing this Patient Zero to go about the business and spreading the smallpox into the interior of the province. It's said by Swanky that even by conservative estimates, this outbreak killed tens of thousands of indigenous peoples within 15 months and completely reshaped this province's cultural and political landscape. Now, Swanky had begun his study when he was helping a filmmaker's son do something on the gold rushes. Historians agree that the period was a seminal turning point in modern British Columbia history, but Swanky kept noticing that most whites described the smallpox epidemic that began in Victoria as accidental and incidental to the major events, while most First Nations oral history sources say the epidemic was deliberately orchestrated and pivotal. This historian who's speaking now is of the former opinion that it was accidental and it was not predisposed and predetermined in this process of a war of extermination that was motivated. But the book itself and the discussions that have gone on ever since have ignited once again the fact of the matter that what disease was the most important factor in the decline of the indigenous peoples of British Columbia, who were estimated at about 80,000 at the time of the colony of Vancouver Island being established in 1849, right through about the low point of 1905, when the decline began to switch and began to improve. This because of better water, better sewage, but moreover because of the fact that public health was now being implemented and that vaccinations were occurring. The low point was a terrible one. We know, for instance, of what happened in 1862, the in 68, then when the Royal Navy vessels convoyed canoes tied end to end to the northern locations, the Queen Charlotte Islands or Haida Gwaii were particularly devastated, and I've written about that. The decline in the numbers there meant that all the old villages, Kamshiwa, Dedans, Nimstins, and others became vacant villages, absolutely deserted. And the concentration of the Haida then concentrated around near Skidigat, Queen Charlotte City on the one hand, and Naden at the north end of the island. It was a terrible and a well-documented example of what happened in the Charlottes or Haida Gwaii at that point in time. Quarantine stations had been operating in eastern Canada for years, screening passengers arriving from Europe for cholera, leprosy, meningitis, smallpox, and tuberculosis. Despite these efforts, deadly pathogens occasionally got through with devastating effect. Among the more well-known stations are New York's Ellis Island, the Lauder Island quarantine station at the mouth of Halifax Harbor, Partridge Island quarantine station off New Brunswick at the mouth of St. John Harbor, and Grosse Isle quarantine station in the St. Lawrence, 46 kilometers down from Quebec City. Many here will remember that during the Great Irish Famine in the year 1847, thousands of Irish immigrants, many of them suffering from typhus, boarded ships destined for the port of Quebec City. Also known as ship fever, that disease, often transmitted by lice and fleas and characterized by a purple rash, delirium, overcrowded and vermin-infested conditions, lasted several weeks, and men, women, and children felled by the disease were hastily buried at sea. You'll know the famous story of the island in the St. Lawrence, Grosse Isle, it's called, where the sailors and the quarantine staff, the healthcare workers and the priests all suffered too in this terrible, grim toll. At the height of the epidemic, the disease spread to Quebec City, St. John, Montreal, Ottawa, and further west along the St. Lawrence into Kingston and Toronto. And typhus in 1847 claimed roughly 20,000 lives in Canada. So I bring these points forward because it seems to me that the West Coast was no stranger to smallpox prior to these episodes. And the sad demise of these wonderful nations and peoples and cultures was a very dramatic thing. And it brings forward the question which has been charged that the decline of the indigenous people was a natural thing that was promoted by the Hudson Bay Company and the traders. But that surely cannot be true, because after all, the trade of the Hudson Bay Company and other traders depended on native transportation, native consumers, native well-being, and so forth. So one is hard to justify the argument that the killing fields were premeditated and planned and complicit. Now, the case of General Amherst sending smallpox-infested blankets to the western tribes west of Pittsburgh has been proven to be false, but the legend lives on that the British intention was there. Whether or not it was effected, and it was not, is another question, and it often remains to be the problem that historians face, that once the myth gets out there, it's very, very hard to deflect the myth and make it into a fact that can be proven to be untrue. I believe this is the case with Swanky's work as well. I do not believe that it was a deliberate plot that the British stood by. The fact of the matter is that there was no health care budget. There were no physicians to carry this out. It was not a policy to quarantine people upon their arrival. But in 1893, the government of Canada secured this wonderful peninsula at Metchosin called William Head. Now, it was opened in 1893, and it represented new hopes for preventing the spread of contagious diseases on the West Coast in the wake of the troubling and embarrassing encounter with smallpox. The process involved the coming of a steamship entering Juan de Fuca Strait. It would come to the docks there. It would tie up. The medical personnel would ask of the captain and the officers what was the state of play, if there was somebody on board stricken with smallpox. The steamer's captain did what was required. He raised a yellow quarantine flag on the vessel's foremast to signal that there was infectious disease on board. And he, along with his anxious passengers and crews, then waited for a response from shore, but nobody would signal the boat, let alone acknowledge the flag's presence. And from time to time, some problems got through in that regard. There were many turns and twists in the saga, but from that point in time right through, the federal authority became really strong in its presence. Now, one could think about COVID and the implications that government authorities faced. The government of Canada has the Canada Health Act. It's uniform for all of Canada and all Canadians. It is implemented by provincial health authorities, however, and so there are variations of this in action on the spot. As the centuries wore on and as the various crises continued in infectious diseases, so too did the governments intervene, usually in response and sometimes after vaccines had been introduced. When I was very young, in the Kootenai country, a great smallpox epidemic developed there. And so swimming pools were closed, water supplies were carefully watched, and so forth. But a lot of people suffered very badly from polio at that period of time. FDR, the President of the United States, was a victim from an earlier period of time. Now we come to William Head's most remarkable story, because the Chinese immigration into British Columbia and Canada came through the western portal of Vancouver, and William Head was in full action of evaluating and screening out any persons who might be ill, and also dealing with the question that, in fact, on board ships, diseases lurked undetected, not only smallpox, but many others as well, typhus being one of them. Every CPR Empress steamship coming through William Head had about 330 to 340 Chinese persons in the steerage. There was always a fee to pay for arrival. There had been an Exclusion Act in 1893, which is an attempt to close things down, and it was completed in the year 1923 with the well-known and infamous Chinese Exclusion Act. But all these ships bringing their human cargo had to be tested and had to be screened, and so William Head was a very important sort of an offshore island of the rest of Canada on the west coast, in which evaluation had to be done, and the ship would not proceed until such time as it was cleared of persons carrying an infectious disease. Of course, in that instance, then, ill immigrants, Chinese and coolie labor, would be treated on shore, and there were deaths that occurred there, and persons buried there as well. The federal government's position on this was in keeping with international regulations which were developing at the time. Now, the First World War brought an amazing twist to this whole story. And I've long been fascinated by the fact that I knew that Chinese laborers were working on the Western Front during the First World War in support of the Allied and principally French side of the war against the Central Powers. I had wondered how many there were, I had wondered how Canada had contributed, if any, to this change or importation of Chinese laborers to the Western Front. But the whole story was revealed recently in a biography of Harry Livingston, who was a Canadian missionary working in China. And in those days, Canada had many missionaries working in China. And Harry Livingston becomes the key authority and leader of this remarkable passage. British government decided that they needed labor on the Western Front. This would free up the soldiers, sailors, and airmen to do their own jobs. The Canadian missionaries were made into officers. Each of them was given a company of 100 Chinese who were tested and evaluated and brought into military organization. It was a quasi-military operation from the beginning to the end. The Canadian Pacific Railway, with its wonderful steamships, the Empress of Russia being the first to bring them across, was involved in this, as were Canadian railways and trains, four or five trains leaving every day from Vancouver for Montreal or St. John, New Brunswick, or Halifax, Nova Scotia, or even in transit to such places as Portland, Maine, if necessary. The missionaries did their noble work. They were very good at this because they had Chinese as a language, and the Northern Chinese who were brought into this arrangement, they were all volunteers. They signed on for adventure, we're told, and they also signed on because they would be paid in hard currency, and that currency, French, would be able to be brought back or sent back to homeland China, which was the Chinese custom of supporting people back home in very impoverished times. Now, here's the most extraordinary figure on this. There were more than 82,000 persons of Chinese extraction who went to the Western Front, but there were 82,000 who were transited by CPR ship to Vancouver, clearing at William Head, and these same 82,000 went on to the Western Front to do important work. It was a secret operation. The press kept the whole thing quiet. The government kept it quiet. Remember, we were working under martial law during the time of this war, under what's called the Canada War Measures Act. And so to prevent any interracial fighting that might occur, the Chinese passage was quiet. There was some damage on board. There were some diseases on board. There were some on the trains. There were some deaths on board the train. But by and large, it was a very, very successful operation. They reached the Western Front in 1917, 1918. Now, that's at the time of Passchendaele and the setting of the guns and the tremendous push that was continued by the Allies against a reinvigorated Imperial Germany. And the war comes to an end in November of 1918. And after this, the Chinese are brought back. They're rearranged into their units, and they're brought back by steamer across the Atlantic to Montreal and other places, boarding Canadian trains, coming to Vancouver, and then being transited to North China, places like Weihaiwei, from which they had come. And that closes the story. It is an amazing story. Now, it can only have been affected by the absolute scrutiny of the officers and medical personnel along the way who were looking out for diseases and would isolate them as soon as they possibly could, because you can imagine a train load of persons with even one person with smallpox on it being a danger to the whole train. The same is true of the ships going back and forth. They had to be carefully screened. There were cases, as known, and this is reported in this book I refer to about Harry Livingston's Forgotten Men. It's written by Don Black, incidentally, a very good book. The possibility of the disease spreading is very rapid. By the early 20th century, to conclude, the medical and jurisdictional arrangements had been put in place for the guarding against the introduction of communicable diseases like smallpox. Smallpox was visible, it was notable, it could be seen. If we come forward to the most recent horror of the COVID story, we're dealing with invisible disease. We could go back to other invisible diseases as well, viral diseases, in which the authorities are trying to, first of all, find out what it is, and secondly, to provide an antidote or vaccine against the spread of it. But the quarantine service was that century's way of dealing with things. Its residue capacities continue in other ways, with immigration and customs dealing with this, and passport controls and medical reports and visas being a way of ensuring this. As in regards to immigration, of course, tightening of regulations dealing with respiratory illnesses has been quite remarkable. And to make sure that immigrants have x-rays of their lungs, which are x-rays of their own lungs and not of some other person who's been brought into the circle to provide a piece of evidence which is absolutely false. Going back to the first point that I made about the indigenous question, there's no doubt about it that the secret killer of so many indigenous persons was a smallpox. That can be verified by the documents. It's notable in the decline of villages, its ravages among the Haida, among the Chilcotin, among the Tsimshian, are notable and horrific. This was a day, we need to remind ourselves, before public measures had come into being to be able to put a stop to this or curtail it. British Columbia was going from a company to a colony to a province, and even the province of Canada, British Columbia, did not have adequate medical facilities or budgets in order to do pre-screening or vaccinations. Reference Alexander Mackenzie, who I mentioned before. His duty as a trader and as a humanitarian was to provide a smallpox a vaccine as much as he could, as long as he had the supply for it. And this was done by the company, the Northwest Company, and I'm sure the Hudson Bay Company traders of Cumberland Lake and Churchill were doing the same as well, but on unlimited arrangements. In conclusion, not in line with the argument that this was a predetermined and destined activity of the British Columbia government, or the Canadian government for that matter, to destroy the Indigenous people. This was not an attempt at genocide. It was a decline in the Native numbers, as I said, and I repeat that, but I do not believe that it was premeditated. Nor do I believe that there was any plan by, say, China to diminish the capacities of Canada and the Canadian population through the introduction of COVID. There's no merit to these kinds of arguments. We are dealing, after all, with secret killers, ones we cannot see, and therein lies the mystery and to some degree the magic of the whole story. So thank you for listening to this podcast in the Cauldron series about British Columbia 1871 to 1914. I'm Barry Goff, and I hope you will join me for other episodes in this remarkable series. Thank you.